Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
There were men with hoary hair amidst the pilgrim band. Why had they come to wither there, away from their childhood's land? There was woman's fearless eye, lit by her deep love's truth. There was manhood's brow serenely high, and the fiery heart of youth. What sought they thus afar? Bright jewels of the mine? The wealth of seas? The spoils of war? They sought a faith's pure shrine. Called it holy ground, the soil where they first trod. They have left unstained what there they found, freedom to worship God. Had you been in the grade school prior to 1970, chances are you would have recited this poem by Felicia Hemans, entitled The Landing of the Pilgrim Fathers. Written in 1826, and with excerpts recently published in Bill Bryson's book Made in America, this work of poetry celebrated the mythic landing of Puritan separatists on Plymouth Rock in November of 1620. Although there were earlier British colonial settlements such as Jamestown and Berkeley, the arrival of the Pilgrims in North America could be said to have set off a wave of migration that eventually culminated in what we know today as the United States. And of course, we celebrate the story of the Pilgrims on the last Thursday every November in a holiday that we call Thanksgiving. Who were these Pilgrims? Why did they leave their homes in England? What was the course of their journey that eventually brought them to Americas? And what legacy did they leave for the development of our nation? To answer these questions, I have the pleasure of welcoming back Thomas Kidd to Research on Religion, our first repeat guest. Professor Kidd is an associate professor of history, senior fellow at the Institute for Studies of Religion, and co-director of the Program on Historical Studies of Religion, all at Baylor University. He is the author of the recently released book, God of Liberty, A Religious History of the American Revolution, from Basic Books, and several other books, including The Protestant Interest, New England After Puritanism, and The Great Awakening, The Roots of Evangelical Christianity in Colonial America, both from Yale University Press. The latter book was recently featured in one of our podcasts about a month ago, and we'll link to all those books and the podcast as well. And Tommy, welcome back to our podcast.
Thanks, Tony.
Well, before discussing the history of the Pilgrims in America, I think it would be wise to focus on where they came from and why they left. So I was wondering if you could give us a brief background about what religious life was back, what was it like back in the 16th century England, the late 1500s, and how did the Pilgrims fit into this landscape?
Well, the background is the Protestant Reformation, which starts in 1517 in Germany, but then spreads to the other countries of Europe. And there's a controversy between Protestants and Catholics over various issues in theology. And at the time, most of the countries have an official state church, and so the battle between Catholics and Protestants in the Reformation is a battle over the fate of the official church. And the Reformation begins in England in the 1530s, when famously Henry VIII wants to divorce his wife, and the Pope won't give permission for this, and so he splits away from the Roman Catholic Church and begins what's called the Church of England. But even by that background, you can tell that the beginnings of the Reformation in England is really more an issue about politics and monarchical power than it is about religious purity. And there are a number of people in England who are dissatisfied with the links to which the Church of England has been reformed and put in line with what they see as biblical theology and practice. And so really in the late 16th century, under the reign of Elizabeth I, is when you have the full development of what's called the Puritan movement in England. And it's easy to understand what the Puritans were trying to do. They were trying to purify the Church of England and make it fully reformed according to their standards.
Now, that name Puritans wasn't one that they adopted. That was a name that was given to them, wasn't it?
That's right. It's a term of insult. They would be called by their enemies the Puritans or the Precisionists. They were seen by their enemies as sort of busybodies, and you know they're too uptight about these religious issues, and they should just leave well enough alone. And so one of the names they were called was Puritans, and that's the name that stuck. But I think the name Puritan is actually really handy because it tells us, you know, what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a more radical group of Puritans who we called the Separatists. And these are the forebears of the Pilgrims who founded the Plymouth Colony. And the Separatists, again, it's easy to tell by their name what they're trying to do. They believe that the Church of England is so corrupt and so just fatally a loss that it is irredeemable. And so the true Christians should separate from the Church of England. But the problem with this is that the Church of England is the official state Church of England and has the backing of the government, and it is illegal at that time to separate from the official state church and have independent church meetings. And so the Puritans wanted to remain within the Church of England and purify it, advocate for reform from the inside, while the Separatists wanted to leave it and start their own churches. And so while the Puritans were viewed as sort of, you know, unpleasant or you know, busybodies, as I said before, difficult people, the Separatists were really viewed as radical, almost criminal types.
Mm-hmm.
in England, and so they were really badly persecuted by the government and the state church.
Now, were they scattered throughout all of England, or were they concentrated geographically? Was it a movement that built upon itself around a few charismatic figures, or what? How did the Separatists really become a separate body, so to speak?
Well, the most famous group of them are around the town of Scrooby. This is not Scooby, but Scrooby.
It has to be one of my favorite towns in all of history, the town of Scrooby. Because
yeah, Scrooby-Doo in England, which is in the East Midlands region of England. And there's a group there who begin to have illegal meetings in the early 17th century, the early 1600s. That is really the famous group, because they're the ones who ultimately lead to the founding of the Plymouth Colony. Now, the Puritans were more widespread, and it's easy to see a kind of degrees of opinion among the Puritans, because some are very moderate Puritans, and they have kind of, you know, problems with certain rituals within the Church of England, but they're not really that bothered about what's going on, all the way down to people who are so frustrated with the Church of England that if they don't see things getting better, they might consider becoming separatists. But with the Separatists, they've crossed a very clear line, which is that they've started having independent church meetings, which are illegal.
Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine that they got quite a bit of grief from the royal government at the time.
That's right. It is illegal. There are set penalties against people who refuse to attend official Church of England services. It's illegal to have these house churches and so forth. And so, again, in the early 17th century, some of these people began to be fined, that sometimes very severe fines, and in some cases even imprisoned for separatist activities. So the Puritan pastors, you know, maybe are being sometimes removed from their churches and taken away from their pastoral charges and this kind of thing, which is significant persecution. But the Separatists around Scrooby were the ones who were really coming under intense pressure to conform, as they would say, to the Church of England.
And that, for me, is an interesting fact, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it's going to come back a little bit later in the podcast when I ask you, you know, how they were able to get over to the Americas, given the fact that they were highly unpopular amongst the royal government, and especially the Anglican Church that was deeply connected with the royal government, how they were able to get territory. We'll come back to that, but I want to hold that out for our listeners right now, just to think about that this was not a very popular group in England at the time. So what eventually pressures these separatists to flee?
Well, all this persecution comes against them, and of course they want the freedom to be able to practice their religion as they saw fit, as they saw the Bible teaching them to do.
Right.
And so there comes a point where some of the separatists begin to try to get out of England, and the most obvious place for them to go first is Holland or the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to leave around 1607, which is actually the same time that the Jamestown colony is being founded by a not particularly religious group of Englishmen, right at the same time, just to get the chronology in order.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why they would go to the Netherlands is because even though the Netherlands is generally Protestant, it's also the most progressive place as far as freedom of religion goes in Europe. And so the Netherlands were picking up various religious refugees and Protestant dissenters of various kinds from Europe and from England. In this case, the separatists decide that they want to go there. And also, it's not very far away. If they go to Amsterdam, that's not taking on too much. And so they move there, and by 1608 or so, they've established themselves there in Amsterdam.
I know that the Huguenot, the Protestant French, many of them fled to the Netherlands at this time. And it was a booming area in Europe at the time, commercially very, very successful. And so it's not at all a bad place to land up, I guess.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and for these kind of people, I mean, it presents an ideal opportunity to get out from under the persecution and be able to practice their religion and freedom.
And so they were there for roughly a decade or so, maybe a little bit more than a decade.
That's right.
And how was life in the Netherlands for the pilgrims?
Well, there was a combination of good and bad. I mean, they in Amsterdam, they are in a very cosmopolitan town, and that offers freedom of religion, but it also offers what they would see as a variety of temptations that comes with a large town and a diverse culture. And they were really, as their enemies characterized them, they were very precise about what to us would seem like pretty fine differences in theology about the practice of the sacraments and this kind of thing. And so they were worried about the influence of Dutch culture, of other kinds of Protestants that they didn't really see as fully biblical. And so over time, I think some of them grew a little nervous about what was going to happen to their children living in Amsterdam, and so some of them began to think about relocating elsewhere.
And that is rather interesting to think about, that they're away from home in a completely immersed in a different culture and then start to feel some dissatisfaction with it. Did they have any linkages or connections back to their homeland, to, you know, England at large or Scrooby in particular, and did they grow over this time, or was there just a simple movement of people in 1607? They all went to the Netherlands and that was a relatively self-contained group, or were they joined by people over the course of the next decade or so?
Well, there are different factions. Some of the separatists actually end up becoming Baptists during this time, and some of them end up relocating back to England. And so they're not completely cut off, especially from the sort of separatist community. Then there's a group of, and when I say they became Baptists, you know, everybody in the Church of England, from, you know, the Puritans and the separatists and just regular people conform to the Church of England practice infant baptism. And there's a small group of the separatists who end up believing that baptism is only for converted adult believers.
Right.
And then, of course, that leads to a split between the regular separatists and the Baptist separatists. And you can see some of these distinctions become pretty fine, and the groups are mm-hmm. are becoming sort of smaller and smaller as they split. But they do maintain contacts back in England, and it is possible in some cases for them to even relocate back to England, even though there's problems, obviously, that they've left behind there of persecution. Some of them think that they'll be better off just casting their lot in England and trying to find places, especially in London, where they might be able to sort of vanish into the crowd and find a place where they can practice in freedom.
In terms of their time in the Netherlands here, for those folks who didn't go back, one could imagine that they start to form a very self-identified community if they hadn't done that already back in England. Does a leadership emerge at this time, and is there concern amongst this leadership that maybe come 1618, 1619, it might be time to be leaving the Netherlands?
Yeah, there's a group of leaders that begin to emerge. The most well-known ones are William Brewster and William Bradford,
mm-hmm.
and they start to develop the plans by which they would ultimately leave. A small group of them would leave and come and establish the Plymouth Colony.
Now, at the time, too, if I'm correct, right around 1620, it looked like there was a war brewing in Europe at the time, and that Netherlands would possibly be one of the fronts of this war. Is that correct?
Well, there's always the possibility that you're going to have a war break out between the Protestant and Catholic countries of Europe. I mean, after the Reformation, I mean, you really have centuries, effectively, of intermittent warfare between the Protestant and Catholic powers, and so that's in the context of their decision, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think right at that time there was a great deal of concern that might not be the safest place to be.
That's right.
And so it's a good time to get out of there, and some have already gone back to England and tried, as you said, to fit in other ways or become parts of other dissenting groups such as the Baptists. But a group of them, a small group of them, as you mentioned, makes it over to the Americas, the British colonies. Now, this is the big mystery for me, because given the fact that, and I had mentioned this early on, that the group had received a great deal of persecution for trying to separate from the Church of England, they were highly unpopular. What on earth was the king thinking when he said, oh, sure, why don't you go over there and have some land, have at it? I just can't figure that out. What's going on there?
Well, with the separatists, they're part of the charter that's given to the Virginia Company. They basically kind of get on as part of that charter for settling colonies in the New World. And I think from the king's perspective, now I don't know how much personal attention James I would have given to this issue, but I think from the crown's perspective in general, I mean, first of all, there's the business value of establishing colonies of almost any sort in the New World,
mm-hmm.
That they saw this as a great opportunity for the expansion of England's power. Other European countries, including Catholic countries like Spain, are founding colonies in the New World. I think England believed that it was time to sort of get with the program. And so I think almost any group that came to the crown and said, you know, we have a viable plan, and here are the settlers we're going to take with us, would have been received, with some openness. And I think that there's also a conflicted kind of feeling towards these dissenting religious groups. On one hand, you know, if they're in England and they're causing you all this trouble, they're breaking the law by establishing these independent churches. I mean, that's that's a problem in England, and one might think about giving them the opportunity to leave. What are they going to do against England if they're there in the New World? I mean, they're totally isolated, and in some ways it gets them out of your hair, as
right.
it were. And so the pilgrims or the separatists are able to attach themselves to the charter that's given to the Virginia Company. And then the Puritans, which, as we talked about, are a separate group that end up founding the Massachusetts Bay Company, similarly are given a charter. And they're really, I think, the most remarkable case, where they are almost just given carte blanche to establish this whole new colony, not just a part of the Virginia Company, but a whole new colony. And I think that really has a lot to do with the fact that John Winthrop, their leader, is just an excellent lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a Puritan by his personal beliefs, but he's also a very accomplished lawyer who some historians think really kind of pulled one over on the English government to get the kind of charter that they did. And yet at the same time, I think from the perspective of the crown, you know, you've got these troublemakers and they want to go to the New World. Okay, you know, this is not a huge problem for the English government, and it also sort of kills two birds with one stone, that it opens up more business opportunities, more opportunities to plumb the natural resources, mineral wealth, and so forth of the New World for England, and to get these dissenters out of your hair. That is not such a bad arrangement. And you see the same thing happen later in the 17th century when the Quakers are given a charter to found Pennsylvania in the 1680s. It's the same sort of situation where the king actually owes William Penn's family money, and this is kind of a way to get the Quakers out and to pay off some debts and hopefully to open up some more business opportunities. So, but I can certainly understand where it seems strange that they're being persecuted in England. Why would they let them leave? But I think in that context of a business opportunity, it makes some sense.
And you were talking of this largely in terms of the royal crown, but you know, from the Church of England's vantage point as well, which is connected to the crown, you can imagine that they're more than happy to get the Puritans, as you say, out of their hair, across a big, huge lake called the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes.
Nobody can see what they're doing, and therefore, hopefully, would stop the spread of any type of puritanical rumblings in the homeland.
That's right.
So now you had mentioned that the pilgrims were associated with the Virginia Company charter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were a small aspect of this, and basically Virginia Company is looking for warm bodies to settle in the Americas, and this is shortly after the Jamestown experiment went poorly, that the Jamestown folks died off and disappeared, didn't look like a great opportunity out there for many people. But here you have these folks who, you know, just want to get out of the way and pursue their own separatist church, and so they sign up with the Virginia Company. Now, where were they originally slated to land? I mean, I remember hearing Plymouth Rock or Massachusetts, as we know it today, was not their intended target.
Now, they were originally supposed to go to the area that became New York City, and the boundaries of the Virginia colony were very vague. It's just sort of generally over there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
they didn't have very good maps, and I mean, they just really didn't know what exactly they were getting into, but they knew from earlier explorations of Henry Hudson and other explorers that there was a fine natural port at the mouth of the Hudson River, and so they had that in mind. But as was so often the case, they didn't exactly know how to get there. They're headed in the right direction when they get to Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd just gotten a little bit further south, they probably would have ended up at the right place, but they're supposed to go to the Hudson River, but they just end up landing at Cape Cod, and that's and then they go a little further inland and end up in what becomes southeastern Massachusetts.
And right before they get there, and this is the famous story that school children are all told about the Mayflower, and they're setting up a government before they set foot onto the land. It becomes famously known as the Mayflower Compact. Now, what is the Mayflower Compact?
Well, this is an agreement that they sign, and the people that are on board the Mayflower, which is the ship that takes them over to the New World, the ship's passengers, the men on board, sign this document. It's a very, very simple document. It's not very long at all. And it just basically sets out the purpose of the colony, and it's kind of an agreement to be to create a government for the colony, and to submit to its rules and regulations, and to the common purpose that they share. And I think in one sense, it's a very understandable and sort of common procedure that they're going through, but at the same time, it's because it's the first kind of compact like this. It's very important. The Virginia colony hadn't done this sort of thing. I mean, they're really a business venture, where I think the Plymouth colonists see themselves as setting up more of a out of whole cloth a kind of political and churchly arrangement out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think historians have seen the Mayflower Compact as the kind of first American Constitution, if you will, even though it's so brief as compared to, say, the U.S. Constitution. It still sets out, a compact of government. We're creating this new government in order to accomplish our common ends and to move forward in our common Christian faith. In that sense, I think it's new, and it gives a really good taste of what kinds of things they had in mind. I mean, I've got the text up in front of me, and it says that they're undertaking for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, and so that they covenant and combine themselves together in a civil body politic. It's so simple, and yet I think it's brilliant in its simplicity.
Right.
Of what kind of government they have in mind, what kind of mission they have in mind together.
Yeah, simple government can oftentimes be very effective in many regards. You talk about how simple it is relative to the U.S. Constitution, but when we think about the U.S. Constitution today relative to, say, the European Union's Constitution right now, it's a major scale differences there. In terms of the Constitution, it's setting up a godly nation to propagate the Christian faith. Now, on board the Mayflower, and this is something that I didn't realize until very recently, it wasn't all just pure pilgrims. There were a number of other non-pilgrims there as well. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, these ships going back and forth, even if you have, these separatist or Puritan groups, they would always have various people along with them. And some of these people later on, the pilgrims brought servants with them. And there were some notorious cases of some of these servants getting into pretty bad trouble for various moral violations and so forth. But no, it's not just pilgrims that are at Plymouth.
But this covenant or this constitution or compact, does that applies to everybody that settles there?
Well, everybody that settles there is expected to live under the terms of the compact and the laws that they pass, and it's not good enough to say, well, I'm not sympathetic to what you're doing. And so those people would be, as I said, there are even really some severe executions for sexual indiscretions and this kind of thing in the early years of the Plymouth colony that to us are sort of shocking. But the idea is if you choose to live here, you're supposed to obey by our rules.
Now, was it just pilgrims that settled Plymouth, or did some of these non-separatists stay over as well.
Yeah, there were non-separatists who stayed over as well. Now, I mean, there's not many of them, and I think most of them would be household or farm servants who were there, brought over to work for the various pilgrims. But there are definitely some there, probably the most famous one is this Nathaniel Morton, who, if I remember correctly, is the one who sets up the maypole and is doing some what they consider to be sort of pagan things with fraternizing with local Native Americans and this kind of thing. But for the most part, there's a pretty uniform character to the colony.
And so they land in November 1620. What approximately was the number of people that were setting foot on Plymouth?
I think you're looking at hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe originally, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's maybe a couple hundred people.
And so how did the first couple years for these colonists go? Going from Amsterdam, an urban environment, to the wilderness, essentially, is probably going to be a fairly big shock to your system. So how did the first couple of years go by for them?
Well, it was hard, and this is the case with most of the very early English colonists in America. They really didn't know what they were getting into, and they often had to turn to local Native Americans to provide for themselves. And so there was a lot of starvation and disease, and the weather was over the winter was unlike anything that they had ever experienced before. And so in the first winter that they were there, about half of the Plymouth colonists die, and that's not an unusual story. That's certainly like what happened in Virginia,
right,
where really most of the early colonists, for the first 10 or 15 years, most of the early colonists end up dying in Virginia too. And so it's just a brutal situation for them. I think that, like, I mean, you admire the sort of pioneering spirit, but you also see the tragedy of that they just did not understand what it was going to take to be able to survive in the New World.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the way they organized their economy, and I've heard this mentioned a few times, and maybe you can add something to this, but they, in essence, tried to form a more communal type of economy at the outset, where everybody contributes to the common good, and this might have been led to some of the problems that they had with people not fully participating in the harvest and such. What's your take on that as a historian?
Well, I think that both at Plymouth and then later on in the Puritan colony in Boston, centered around Boston, Massachusetts, they're not modern sort of 20th century, socialists or something like that, but I think that they do have a kind of Christian sensibility of providing for one another. And the Puritans in particular would just simply not put up with anyone being destitute or homeless. They would always find some way to be able to provide for everyone because they thought it was their Christian obligation. And they also had what would seem to us to be pretty surprising laws about harsh laws against price gouging and selling any kind of products above market value or for any kind of extreme profit taking. They really monitored those kind of practices in a way that would seem to us to be very intrusive. But it is kind of a Christian commune in a certain way. I mean, and in a way, I think it's sort of attractive. I mean, it's a very small group of people. It's not like a kind of top-down government program, telling people what to do in a vast country, like modern socialism would be. But it's a kind of village-based economy where everyone knows each other, And if someone is not doing well in terms of their harvest or something like that, the neighbors would know about it, and they would take care of one another and make sure to share with each other alike, so that everyone had, you know, roughly the same amount of food. And this is also in the context of, for so much of the early years of these colonies, I mean, they're in survival mode. And so if you don't share with somebody, it could very easily turn into a life or death issue for them.
And for yourself, too. I mean, your,
that's right,
your survival is contingent upon everybody else's survival. When you're only talking a couple hundred individuals, you do need a group to survive a very difficult winter and the harshness of the wilderness at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I think it's really an appealing model. I mean, I don't know how you would live it out in the modern world, really, but, you know, certainly there are some, you know, kind of Christian communes that have come up in the past 30 or 40 years that have tried to adopt this sort of model of living. One of my favorite stories about the Puritans, actually, on this point is I tell my students to watch out for stereotypes about the Puritans and the Separatists, and one of them is that the Puritans had no problem at all with drinking alcohol. Now, they were opposed to drunkenness, but they drank beer and hard cider and so forth all the time. And there was a group of Puritans in Dorchester in England, I think around 1610, who were very concerned about, in their growing town, they had more destitute people all the time, and they were trying to think of a way to provide for poor relief. And so there was a group of the Puritans who opened up a brewery, and they sold the beer and used all the profits that they took from the beer sales to give to the poor. Mm. And you know, to me, that they don't sound like too bad of people to me. I mean, you know, it's not like the 19th century, you know, kind of Nathaniel Hawthorne image of these, you know, killjoys.
Right. Just,
you know, they just hated everybody and wanted to get everybody for some kind of obscure religious violation. I think they thought really seriously about how do we live in charity and hospitality with our fellow neighbor, you know, fellow villager. I mean, that's the kind of life that they live. But it's not, you know, again, socialism takes on a kind of a top down government driven sort of program, and I don't think that's really what they were about.
Yeah, in many ways, you know, it's easier to set up a style of governance and economic distribution like that in rather small communities. We recently had a podcast with Michael McBride talking about the Mormons and how they use a very similar model and just breaking things down to very small sizes. A ward is what their name for essentially a parish would be, and the same kind of organization that you saw with the Pilgrims is similar in some of these other smaller communities. Going back to the issue of the beer and the Puritans, this is something new to me, that I would have thought that they are very strict on any type of alcohol consumption. In fact, we call people who are teetotalers puritanical.
That's right.
And nowadays, but I guess now that I think back on it, it only makes sense that, you know, at the time, you know, stores of water might not be all that good. They might be brackish, might be filled with bacteria, and, you know, having a keg of beer is probably a safer source of liquid than maybe your water sitting around.
That's right, and that's indisputable in the 17th century that beer or hard cider is probably going to be about the most healthy thing that you can drink, especially as compared to water. And it's also it keeps you know it's fermented, and so it keeps for a long time, and it was just you know, the healthiest thing for them to drink. And when they looked at their Bibles, I mean, they're Bible people, they don't see any prohibitions against drinking. Instead, they see Jesus changing water into wine and so forth. And so what they were opposed to was drunkenness, but not drinking. That's really that changed to being anti, you know, drinking period is really a 19th century change that comes to certain American Christians.
Well, how were the relations with the indigenous populations? They didn't come to a barren wilderness where it was completely uninhabited, but there were folks hanging around at the time to greet them when they came in. How were those relations with the native population?
the Plymouth colonists came very quickly and famously to depend on local natives to help them understand how to grow corn. And in that first winter, the colonists who survived did so partly on the basis of borrowing from local Native Americans. And so the image of that first Thanksgiving was partly a thankfulness for the generosity of local Native Americans for sharing with them. But the Plymouth colonists did a little better over time with relating to local Native Americans, partly because the Plymouth colony never really grew very much. I'm afraid that the Puritan colony in Massachusetts had a pretty dismal record of relating to Native Americans. They grew much more quickly, and so there was almost immediately land issues with local Native Americans. And by 1636, Massachusetts is founded in 1630, and then in 1636 you're already having a terrible war between the Puritans and the Pequot Indians that results in the almost total annihilation of the Pequot tribe. And this pattern of bad relations with local Native Americans blows up finally in the 1670s with King Philip's War, which by the percentage of people killed is the deadliest war in all of American history. And it wipes out huge percentages of both Native Americans and English colonists, and is just an absolutely brutal war. The Puritans do make some halting efforts at evangelizing Native Americans. This is one of their stated reasons for coming, of course, is to say that we want to bring the gospel to what they considered a pagan, lost people. But I'm afraid that fighting these wars with them didn't do anything to help them to be able to share the gospel with these folks, even though there are certain Native Americans who do become Christians.
Mm-hmm. Well, you make another interesting point here, and it's one that we made earlier, is that there is a difference between the Pilgrims that came over and settled Plymouth Colony and the Puritans that came in several waves roughly a decade after the Pilgrims set foot on Plymouth. How is the relationship between the Pilgrims, who had this small corner of Massachusetts, and the rest of the Puritans, as you mentioned, they come wave after wave and grow and grow and grow? How did those relations go, considering how we mentioned earlier that the Pilgrims were separatists, but the Puritans wanted to work within the Church of England?
Well, the Plymouth colony tended to be fairly isolated, even though we're talking about just in, you know, Massachusetts. And Plymouth is its own entity, operating initially under the Mayflower Compact. It's its own colony, and it's technically part of Virginia, but they really have their own independent existence. And then in the 1690s, Plymouth is absorbed into the larger Massachusetts colony. And I think that there is some initial tension between the Puritans and the Separatists, because the Puritans specifically did not want to become Separatists, because they believed that God would still had a future for the Church of England. But the fact of the matter is that by coming to Massachusetts, the Puritans were functionally acting like Separatists. They're running away, cutting off their relations with the Church of England. And so they're Puritans in name, but in a lot of ways they really are acting like Separatists. And I think that there's a generally congenial, if somewhat distant, relationship between the authorities in Boston and then the Plymouth colony. And then because of some changes that happened in the 1680s and 90s with the government of Massachusetts, ultimately I think Plymouth is fairly easily absorbed into Massachusetts, and Plymouth and Massachusetts, for instance, fight alongside one another in King Philip's War. And so by the time you get to the 1670s and 80s, the time is right for Plymouth just simply to be absorbed. So I think historically, really, Massachusetts is a much more significant colony, even though it's founded 10 years after the Plymouth colony.
Mm-hmm. And that only seems to make sense, what you're saying here, in that, you know, the Puritans who do come, who still want to work within the Church of England, are, you know, start to set up their own institutional structures and months away in terms of communication with the homeland back in England. And so, you know, one would naturally just become a separatist church. And so one could see the Pilgrims and the Puritans in Massachusetts moving closer and closer over the course of several decades.
That's right.
What is, when we think of this now, and we're just talking about how the Pilgrims are absorbed into the Puritan Massachusetts, or later becomes known as the Congregationalist Massachusetts, what is the legacy of the Pilgrims per se, and then maybe what is the legacy of the bigger group known as the Puritans for American history?
Well, I think that part of it is that you see in New England in particular, I mean, there's this debate about, you know, were the colonies founded for religion or primarily for business? And I think that even though the Pilgrims and the Puritans were both very active in all kinds of business, and they would make money if they could, that these colonies are clearly being founded for religious reasons in New England. Now, when you go further south, it's a more mixed bag. I mean, when you look at Virginia, religion is not at the forefront of what they're doing. But these are the examples you would look to if you want to see a sort of Christian mission behind the founding of the colonies, as it's stated in the Mayflower Compact. They've laid out very clearly that they're trying to establish a colony for the glory of God, and you know that's part of America's religious and cultural heritage, and I think that shouldn't be forgotten. And we also shouldn't forget that not all the colonies are founded exactly for the same reason.
Right.
And then, you know, there's a, I think, a kind of sense of divine mission that especially the Puritan colonies bring to America. You know, John Winthrop, the governor, has this idea that Massachusetts will be a city on a hill. He references that in his most famous sermon to the Puritan colonists, that the eyes of the world are upon us, and that everyone will be looking to see what it's like to set up a new place, a new government and church that's fully in accord with biblical standards. Europe is watching, he says, and they want to know how this is going to turn out. And I think of that kind of sense of America as a city on a hill, as having this moral, a divine mission, a God-ordained mission in the world, has sort of colored the way that America tends to see itself, I think sometimes for good and sometimes not for so good, you know, depending on what we're doing. But Americans tend to want to see that we're not just, you know, some kind of, you know, pragmatic, money-making, money-grubbing people, but that we have loftier purposes too. And then for the purposes of this show, I mean, one of the most obvious legacies is the memory of that first Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously every November rolls around and we think about the memory of the Pilgrim Fathers sharing a meal together and being thankful for God seeing at least some of them through that awful first winter there at the colony. And that's one of the most common routine cultural references that we as Americans make back to the colonial period, and I think that's an important legacy as well.
Yeah, it's attached very well to our historical memory, and we think of the Thanksgiving holiday, you know, dating back to 1621. In reality, it's, you know, the holiday itself doesn't really become an official holiday until the middle part of the 19th century. I think it was Abraham Lincoln that officially declared it on the last Thursday of November, if I'm correct.
Yeah, well, what happens is that, you know, the colonial governments are routinely proclaiming days of prayer and fasting and Thanksgiving, but they're usually keyed to something that's actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a victory in a war or something like that would lead to the government proclaim a day of Thanksgiving, and so it was contingent on a certain event. And that was the practice of the United States government, at least occasionally, beginning with the Washington administration.
That's right.
And from time to time, governments would, the administrations would proclaim days of Thanksgiving. And Abraham Lincoln, as you mentioned, did that in the middle of the Civil War. The Confederate government was doing it too. And Lincoln set the precedent for having it in November the way that we do it today, and it was consistently declared by the presidents from that point forward. But then in during the Franklin Roosevelt's administration, Congress made it an official national holiday that we would observe the last Thursday of November as our Thanksgiving Day. And from that point forward, I think it has become significantly more secularized and, kind of business-oriented, really, a time to, kind of eat turkey and watch the NFL and do the, it's a family time and this sort of thing. But I think we probably tend to forget that it's not just general Thanksgiving, but as the colonists began it, it was specifically Thanksgiving to God for these kind of specific blessings that he had given. So I think that the Plymouth colonists probably would be somewhat disturbed at what what Thanksgiving has become. And nevertheless, I think there is a kind of continuity of having an official day of Thanksgiving.
And I think you make that point very well as you talk about the legacy of the Pilgrims and the Plymouth Colony, that this was founded, our nation was founded on something more than just a commercial venture, but has a sense of spiritual guidance or spiritual reckoning behind its purpose. And you think back on in terms of American history over the past several centuries and how that really has shaped our vision of the world and in turn shaped the regular vision of the world, right? Just a group of people coming out of a small town called Scrooby, making their way over to the Netherlands, and then eventually planting foot over here in the North American colonies in that regard. So one last question that I have to ask you, given the secular nature that Thanksgiving has become, who do you like on November 25th, the Saints or the Cowboys?
Well, I'm in Texas, so you know the answer to that.
Oh, okay. Well, isn't Waco closer to Louisiana than... Well, I guess it's pretty close to Dallas.
Nope, it's not.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm going to be cheering for the Cowboys as well, too. And Tommy, I want to thank you for joining us today on Research on Religion, and I wish you great blessings for the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday.
Thank you. You too, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.